Greetings to all you out there in podcast land. This is Adam Voigt, and you're listening to The Aristotle Project. The Aristotle Project works to bring back ancient wisdom for the modern world. We do have original thoughts and our own philosophy separate from Aristotle, but unless you understood Aristotle, you wouldn't understand anything we have to say that's original. So we created this so that you could catch up with us someday. But along the way, Aristotle is quite a roller coaster ride. So buckle up and we're on our way. What is knowledge? What is the highest knowledge? Can the highest knowledge be gained from observation of nature? Can it be gained from mathematics? Can we find it in religious myths? What is ultimately real? What is substantially real? These are the questions asked by Aristotle in the Book of Books, Book Alpha of the Metaphysics. And our current series deals with this very short but very difficult work. I hope you'll enjoy the Aristotle Project.
Okay, so here's episode 3 of the Aristotle Project, or maybe we're going to name it Ada, Adam, and Aristotle. I'm not sure yet. I'm kind of leaning towards the Aristotle Project, but maybe Ada, Adam, and Aristotle. I don't know. But anyway, this is episode 3 of our journey. And now, so we looked at that philosophy is the study of causes and principles. Then we looked at like the first causes, because there's other things that are underneath, you know, and lower than philosophy. And now we're going to look at examples of causes, like specific types of causes. Okay, and our first one today is matter. And it's pretty cool that he starts with this, because he likes matter a lot. He talks a lot about matter. And it's pretty interesting. And we started our first conversation talking about matter the other day, and that's what gave me the idea to let you help me out with these podcast episodes. So, when we talked about matter, we made our way to the soul eventually, but today we're just going to talk about matter. We're not going to worry about the soul. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, good. So, in chapter 3, he says, we're looking at the causes, at causes and principles. Now, he has another book called The Physics. And he says, in that book, I've listed 4 basic types of causes. Now, we're going to look at some other people who've written before him and who were famous back in his day and see what types of causes they've written about. But he thinks there's no other types of causes than these 4. And they are the essence or the form, the matter, the source of motion, and the purpose or the good or the end of a cause. Those are the 4 causes. So those are like 4 causes, capital F, capital C. That's a famous thing that Aristotle came up with. So he's going to start with matter. Matter is pretty fundamental. And back in Aristotle's day, most people thought matter wasn't really real. I'm not talking about normal people. They all thought matter was totally real. But I'm talking about philosophers, right? So Aristotle's teacher was Plato. And Plato, it's hard to know what Plato thought about matter, but Platonists generally thought matter was either not real or even evil or bad, right? And why anyone would think that is hard to explain, but Aristotle, basically, you know, he was the opposite of that. He thought matter was pretty real. It's not the most real thing that exists, but he says it's pretty real, and almost anything that exists has to have matter, you know, if it's like a really real thing. So he's definitely interested in matter. And so when he's talking about these people and criticizing them, he's bringing them back because they're out of fashion in his day. Most people thought philosophy was done with matter. They were into like mathematics and other weird ideas that lasted forever. So anyway, we'll talk about matter. So, and he says, okay, if we can't find any more causes than these four, then we know we've got a good list. So, the early philosophers, they believed that the primary cause was matter. Now, they had a word for the primary cause, and it was the arche, which means the first thing. And so it not only means the first thing in terms of time, but the first thing in terms of awesomeness or reality or coolness, right? Like a prince was called an archon, like a ruler was called an archon, someone who's in charge of things, that's a ruler, right? So that means the first thing. And like the ancestor of a tribe, like, is the archon of that people. Like the first Kentuckian was Daniel Boone. The first Hebrew was Abraham. The first human was Adam. And that's another sense in first. So people thought, the earliest philosophers thought that matter was the first thing. That matter has to exist first. And then the thing can come to exist, right? That's made from matter. So that seems to mean it's more real. All right. So matter is that from which all things, that of which all things consist, and that from which they are formed. And then when they die or are destroyed, they go back to being matter. So those are the three things he says about matter. And one thing that they said, the early materialists said, was that nothing really comes to be or is destroyed, because the matter is always there. You know, the matter never goes away completely. It can't be completely destroyed. You know, you could split it up into smaller bits, you can smoosh it together, but you can't destroy it. It's eternal. Yeah, and most people actually think that. I kind of think that too. So that seems to make them think that matter is really real. All right, so the first person he talks about, and who is the first scientist, we would call him a scientist, was Thales. So Thales lived in a town called Miletus, or Miletus, which was in Turkey. It was completely destroyed by the king of Persia, actually, so it's no longer in any form at all. But it was philosophy and Greek science were invented there. So, in this, Thales did and said a lot of things. He was an interesting guy. But what he said, and that's relevant to this chapter, is that everything was water. That's basically. But you know what he means by that, right? That sounds kind of dorky. Surely there's things that are different.
In order for something to be, it has to incorporate water somehow or something.
Well, yeah, that's one meaning. That's true.
Like in order to animals to, or for any of the kingdoms to exist, there's got to be water.
That's true.
And in order for like to have like, I don't know, pretty much everything in this room somehow had water in it.
Yeah, it's true. That's the interesting thing is there's two contradictory ideas which both seem to give water some kind of primacy.
Mm-hmm.
And one is that one that you just alluded to is that, let's say you're out in the middle of nowhere and there's just a total desert and it's totally flat and rain falls out of the sky. And in a few days, you'll see that plants and all kinds of living things just manifest out of nowhere, right? And the Greeks and the people of the Mediterranean noticed this quite a bit. So that's an interesting thing, is that rain has water, which creates life out of nowhere. And then all food has a little bit of water in it, it seems. And living creatures have water in it. More water than non-living things, like rocks and stuff. They have water in it. So That's one thing. But then there's another contradictory thing that comes from ancient mythology and religion, and that is that at one time there was nothing but water. And like, for example, in the Bible, when God shows up at the very beginning, there's nothing but water. There's all this water, and it's just completely empty, just like Uranus, or Uranos in Greek. Uranos is this cosmic ocean, which is infinite in every direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of what God saw before he started to make the world. So in one sense, there's nothing, and then water comes, and things come from nowhere, right? But then in another sense, at the beginning, there was nothing but water, and then water, everything was made out of water, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those are two senses. I don't know how those can agree, but Aristotle's clearly aware of both of these sorts of things. Because he says that the precursors of Thales' thought were like ideas about Oceanus and Tethys, who were two names for the primal cosmic ocean. And other peoples had similar gods and goddesses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another thing he mentions, that the gods swear by the river Styx. So the river Styx is this river between what we would call Middle Earth, right, and the other world. So there are these two worlds. In between them, there's water, and they swear by that. And so he says, well, if the gods swear by something, like humans swear by the gods when they promise.
Mm-hmm.
But if the gods swear by a body of water, well, that means that water is greater and of more awesomeness than even gods, mm-hmm. right? Even Zeus, right? So that's things that people...
What about the goddess, like river Styx?
Oh, yeah, most rivers actually had a spirit.
Yeah.
That somehow, sometimes showed up in stories. So that's an interesting thing. I don't know... I don't know if there was a Styx.
Did she just, like, not swear on anything?
Well, she doesn't need to swear, you know. What would she swear about, you know? She doesn't need to promise. If you're like God. Mm. You know, I mean, although, you know, in the Bible, God does make promises to people. But, you know, he doesn't swear by anything. And he tells people not to swear either. I don't know. That's pretty interesting. But, anyway, so... That's the ideas of it. So, in this sense, so he thought that there was this primal matter, and then somehow water could change into other things, like us and, you know, air, and I guess even fire and earth, right? And so this is it's a very common idea. If you think about, like, Turtle Island, you've heard about that.
Yeah.
At first, there was just nothing but water. And then they say, well, there's, like, various animals swimming in the water. And they dig things up out of the bottom of the water and put it on top of Turtle's back. And somehow, that's like, it's kind of like making things out of water. But in another sense, it's very primitive. I don't know.
But no, they were making, like, the dirt was just expanding.
Yeah, it was just at the bottom of the ocean, right?
Yeah, and then wasn't it just expanding, though? That had nothing to do with water.
Oh, it could have.
Unless the water was magic. I don't remember the story very well.
But it seems like many very early, very, very primitive Stone Age myths are kind of simplistic like that. They, like, you know, like when Raven stole the light, you know, he created the world, but yet the world was already there. It just wasn't lit up, right? He doesn't really make... He made humans out of another living creature and made the world by just turning on the light, right?
Mm-hmm.
So many, but the Greeks were the first people to, like, really think, well, you know, what in the world is it really all about? So let's say, you know, there was nothing but water and God, right? Or was there water, fire, and God? You know, they wanted to have all their bases covered. So... Anyway, so there were two people, Thales and a guy named Hippo, which is funny. Some guy was named Hippo, but it just means horse in Greek, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Thales and Hippo thought that the Arche was water. And then someone named Anaximenes and said that it was air. So air, he gave arguments like, because living creatures have to breathe. And once they stop breathing, they die. Right? And then air is like, seems like to fill the whole universe. And he thought that maybe water condensed out of air. In this, like that when it rains. And then earth condensed out of water. So he, Anaximenes came up with the idea of rarefaction, or really developed it. So he thought the air was the primary, like the archae, the primary element, right? And then another guy argued in favor of that, whose name was Diogenes of Apollonia. And then another guy said, a couple of people said it was fire. Actually, this was pretty common to say it was fire. Heraclitus is a really interesting guy to read from Ephesus. And he said it was fire. And then the Pythagoreans tended to think it was fire.
Why do they think that?
Well, because if you think about it. So if everything condenses and then rarefies, right?
Oh, and then fire is like above air?
Yeah. So what's the most rarefied element?
Fire.
That's the primary thing. Yeah. So they thought that, for various reasons, they thought fire was more rare than air. That means its particles are smaller. So the smaller particles are more fundamental than the big ones, because the big ones have to be made out of the smaller ones. Just like quarks are more primary than protons and neutrons. And I think electrons, neutrons, and protons are all made of quarks. I just kind of assume, right? And then I think quarks are made out of something else. So the smaller particles are always the more fundamental. And also, they're higher energy. They have more energy. Even today, that's true. The smaller particles have higher energy. You have to put a lot, like you have to zoom them around that CERN.
What's a quark?
A what?
What's a quark?
A quark is what protons and neutrons are made out of.
That's it? There's, yeah. What is a quark, though?
Well, there's six flavors of them. There's like up, down, left, right, strange, and beauty. Or I think there's six kinds. You have to look it up. They're kind of cute names. And the word quark comes from this poem by Lewis Carroll, in which he has lots of nonsense words. You know, like vorpal, and I forget. It's just meant to sound like dumb, something dumb. Yeah, but that's what
they're called. Wait, are they actually words?
I don't know. I have no idea what the evidence for quarks are. But at least everyone agrees on that there are quarks today. All the physicists agree that there are quarks, and mm-hmm. that's more fundamental than protons. Whereas back in the day, back in Aristotle's day, or the day of these people, they couldn't agree on what was the most fundamental. It seemed that most people thought that fire was more fundamental, but how fire could create life is another thing. Like, what does it have to do? Well, are all living creatures more fiery than...
Well, fire would condense into air and water and earth, and then they would, mix together.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that. I mean, living things are more warm. But the thing is, you can come up with good arguments for any one of these being the primary one. The only one that nobody said was primary was Earth. Nobody said it was primary. Earth seems to be not well respected. Back then, they just thought it was like dirt, you know? They didn't like it. And so, another argument the Pythagoreans gave was that, well, fire is in the center of the universe. And when the sun rises, then all the animals wake up.
Oh, and the sun's made out of fire now.
Yeah, and then, and like the, and in a farm,
okay.
You know, the center of, is center of everybody's life is the fire in the kitchen, right? Or the fire in the workshop, right? Or the fire where you're doing lots of work with fire, blacksmithing and stuff, if you're in traditional.
And there are multiple gods of that.
So those fires are very important in the focus of everything and constantly tended and cared for. Whereas if you have a pile of dirt, nobody cares, right? You know? So that's something that they actually said, was that dirt piles are useless. So they thought, in that sense...
But you need dirt to do other stuff.
That's true, but you don't, like... You know, there is a movie called Quest for Fire, you know, a bunch of cavemen who lose their fire, but they don't go on a quest for dirt. You know, dirt's everywhere, right?
Yeah.
But fire is, like, really special. Like, if you don't have fire, you're totally screwed. So that's the thing, but nobody could quite agree on, there was some lack of agreement, and it seemed incomplete, and we'll talk more about how incomplete it was. But there was even a famous guy who I like a lot. He's really cool. I did my master's thesis on him, called Empedocles, and he said, none of these four elements are more fundamental than the other. They're all equally fundamental, and there's four of them. So this guy's name was Empedocles, right? And so he... So that made sense. Actually, that was very popular for, like, actually about 2,000 years, right? And it's closer to our current idea of an element in terms of, like, hydrogen, helium, whatever. So he was thinking in terms of, like, hydrogen, helium, beryllium, calcium, you know, iron, oxygen, those elements. Whereas what other people were talking about is more like quarks. They were looking for, like, the fundamental particle, right? But they weren't really ready to find the fundamental particle, you know? I mean, they're nowhere close to being able to find it. But, you know, people did know about actual elements in the sense that we think of. Like, copper is an element in our modern sense, right? Gold, silver.
Okay, so they knew that there are different things. So how could, like, fire somehow condense into, like, oxygen?
Well, they didn't know about oxygen. Like, oxygen, like...
They just thought air?
They didn't know that that air was actually made of multiple elements.
What did they do know about... So they just knew about the earth elements?
Yeah, they... Like, so they knew that there were, like... They thought that there were seven metals. And that, you know, even people who believed in four elements thought that there were seven metals. Don't tell me how they thought they were related. Like, I wrote, like, you know, 100 pages on Empedocles, and I never saw anywhere where he talks about how you get the metals from,
logic?
The four elements, right? You know, he never mentions it. Empedocles seems to be focused on living creatures. He doesn't really care about the metals yet, which is weird. So that's what everybody at the beginning focused on matter. So that's the, let's see here. And... So those people, but they weren't quite ready for it yet. So there was another group of people who thought, who rethought the concept of matter, and they're called the atomists. They came up with the idea of the atom.
Mm-hmm.
And so the word atom comes from uncuttable, the word uncuttable in Greek. And it means you can't cut it. So, like, entomology means... A living creature that has segments that are, like, divided discreetly, as opposed to us, which our skin is continuous, right? That's why insects have, like, pieces of armor, right? And so they're cut-up creatures. But something which can't be cut is an atom.
Wait, so insects are uncuttable or something?
No, they're cuttable.
We're uncuttable?
They're already naturally cut up because they have segments.
That's weird.
Yeah, whereas, like, a blob or a human is, like, a continuous creature, right? Like,
but you could...
Like, we don't have a piece of armor here and then a joint.
Yeah, but you could cut up a blob and there'd just be two blobs. You can't cut up a human and have there having two
humans. Oh, yeah, that's true. But, anyway, that's just to show you what tomos means. Like, an operation where you cut... Appendectomy means you cut the appendix out of someone. Tomy means cutting. So it's something that's uncuttable. So in the original sense of the word atom, it's something that can't be split. Like, we know that atoms can be split. And that means they're not really atoms, according to the Greeks. They're not. An atom, by definition, is something that can't be split. So they thought, well, there have to be some fundamental, smallest piece of matter that can't be cut anymore. Because even if you have, if it could keep on being cut forever, then the smallest bit would be infinitely small. But then you can never make anything finitely big out of infinitely small things. This is how they thought about matter. So there has to be some particle that's the smallest. And so we kind of do believe that, even like in quantum physics, there's a smallest bit of space and time, and the smallest bit of matter. Like, we think that matter is non-continuous. So that's something that we have in common with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they said that one thing that they introduced that no one else believed in was the concept of empty space. So in order to make the pieces of matter like self-contained little parts and to give them room to move around in, they had to think that there was empty space around it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people didn't like this. There's this old saying, nature abhors a vacuum, which means a void or an emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you tried to empty something out, you know, it would just be filled up instantly by nature. And a lot of people, like...
Wait, so, like, if you had, like, a can or, like, I don't know, like, a glass bottle or something, and then you, like, somehow sucked the air out of it, the air wouldn't be, like, strong enough to suck out, or it just wouldn't suck out, or would like the glass break in?
Well, no, the fact that you could arbitrarily create a vacuum to them wouldn't be proof that there was empty space by nature, and it would seem kind of like dorky to claim that that was informative about nature, because nature is by definition what happens most of the time. And of its own accord. You shouldn't have to force things to happen in order to find out about nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, I'm pretty sure that it's obvious that you can tinker with nature and cause unnatural things to happen, which show something about nature. But back then, people kind of wouldn't have thought that...
it would be like if nature was put in this... like situation, what would nature do?
Yeah, they didn't do many. There were very few experiments that were done back in the day, but not nearly as many as we would look for if we were transported back to that age, you know. But there were a few, and we'll talk about them. But like most of the evidence for atomism is just conceptual. Like, they just looked at, you know, people arguing about which form of matter was the most fundamental. And they thought, well, you know, none of these is really fundamental. There has to be something that can form any of these things, but it's just different. And they thought that there was just solid matter in empty space, and then the different elements were like different chunks of solid matter, different sizes, and different arrangements of them. And each chunk might be a different shape. So they thought that, like, the atoms of fire, and they thought that fire wasn't made of atoms, were very small.
Wait, was or wasn't?
That they thought it was. So if you read guy named Lucretius, who wrote, like, a big, long, epic poem in Latin about atoms, right? It's so funny. It's a good book to read, but... He said,
wait, it's a book?
Yeah, it's a whole book. It's like as long as the Iliad, right? But it's just about the cosmos and society and life and about atoms. But he talked about atoms of fire. Like, when you get warm, that means atoms of fire are going through your other atoms, which are larger, in between the spaces in those atoms. So they thought that even though... like, the fact that some things are more dense than others shows that the atoms in the dense things are closer together, and the atoms in the less dense things must be further apart, because how could one thing be way more than another if there wasn't empty space in between the parts of the less dense object? This is the argument that they use. They wouldn't experiment. But they would just point at the fact that, you know, one thing was less dense than another, and that heat would get into a thing, like heat would go from one side and you could feel it on the other side of the thing. So they would say that there were little bitty particles of heat or fire that would go through, and then they would fill up that thing, all the spaces in between those atoms in the wall or the stone or something. So that's how they thought of fire. So they thought that fire was the smallest of the atoms, and that it was like, most of the people thought it was pointy in some way. And like Plato thought, he thought the atoms, insofar as they existed, were like triangular. Probably they were tetrahedrons, which is like when you have four triangles. And that's, I think that's what he thought the atom was shaped like. He thought they were all shaped like the platonic solids. And the most pointy and jagged one was the tetrahedron. And it, and that's why it hurt when you touch it. It's not because it was moving fast and had a higher energy level like what we think. So they were thinking about matter in this way. And so atomism is like actually...
Wait, but if there's like so small, like how the heck are we supposed to like... I don't know how we feel, but there are little things in our hands that feel, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're not smaller than fire atoms.
No, they're bigger than, yeah.
So how would we feel the tiny spikes of a tetrahedron?
It would bump into those atoms, our big atoms, and you'd feel it. At first, you'd feel warmth. You know, but then if there was a lot of them, it would just burn you away or hurt you and then burn you. And you would need a lot of it in order to burn like your big, heavy, cold atoms. And of course, you have air atoms too, which are very close to the size of fire. And you do have, by nature, you have to have a lot of fire atoms already in you, but just a very small amount. And that has something to do with your life force. Or, you know, they would debate about which is the life force. What's the soul? Is it the air or is it the fire? You know, they would debate, or maybe it's the water. Or maybe it's all three of those, plus the earth, you know. This is what they would argue about. And but atomists would say that there's no such thing as a soul apart from the atoms. Whatever kinds of atoms there are, and whatever combinations those atoms can form, that's all that there is.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else exists. And so they thought that they were gods, but they lived way off in space in on other worlds. When they say worlds, they don't mean like Venus and Jupiter. They mean like other solar systems. And so he thought...
Wait, they knew about solar systems? And yet no, they thought they that the world was flat and surrounded by water?
No, this is after... Atomists came after they discovered the world was round. And so that was very soon. That was in Parmenides' day. And they discovered the world was round. And in fact, I think it was Epicurus, or one of the atomists, who came up with the idea that there have to be other worlds. There probably are other worlds, because they thought that there was like a wall, like we were on the inside of a big basketball. There was a hard wall. And then what's on the other side of that? There has to be something. So why not another world? You know? It's like kind of ridiculous to think that that's the only thing. So he thought the gods probably are beings that can wander between the worlds. And, he thought that there had to be an infinite amount of space. And if there's an infinite amount of space, there's probably an infinite amount of worlds. And there's probably infinitely many things. And among those infinitely many things, you know, chance just dictates that there's one that pretty much lives forever. Or a few. And these are the gods. And he thought the gods don't even know we exist. And he says it's kind of actually dumb or really wrong, wrong-headed to think that they listen to your prayers, but that it's best for humans to worship the gods because it's just good for us. That's what he thought they were. And it's kind of like people believing in aliens, right? They like to believe in aliens, and it's really cool to think about them, but we know they don't exist. I like believing in aliens. You know, I think it's really good to think about what we could become someday, right?
Yeah, I think there's aliens.
Yeah, but like it's I think it's an important part of my mind to believe in that. Anyway, that's kind of a sidetrack, but that's how big the philosophy of atomists were, and it's all based on their concept of matter. And they came up with this really brilliant concept of matter. And that's pretty much the most advanced concept of matter that was back then. So I think that that's the about as much as of matter that we can talk about here. That's okay, so the next cause, once people had got a handle on matter and they were debating it, they realized that what was next needed to know about was what causes matter to move.
Mm-hmm.
And not just move, but what causes it to come together to make things. So the earliest... So Aristotle claims that the earliest thinkers lacked a concept of efficient cause. And, I mean, I don't know, like, okay, so like the earliest thinker, that's Thales. He believed in water, but he believed when water falls on dry, barren soil, stuff just pops out of nowhere, right? So something had to make all those plants that grow out of the desert, right? And then, you know, maybe there was Oceanus, the infinite ocean, cosmic ocean that came, was before, had got a handle on matter, and they were debating it. They realized that what was next needed to know about was what causes matter to move.
Mm-hmm.
And not just move, but what causes it to come together to make things. So the earliest, so Aristotle claims that the earliest thinkers lacked a concept of efficient cause. And, I mean, I don't know, like, okay, so like the earliest thinker, that's Thales. He believed in water, but he believed when water falls on dry, barren soil, stuff just pops out of nowhere, right? So something had to make all those plants that grow out of the desert, right? And then, you know, maybe there was Oceanus, the infinite ocean, cosmic ocean that came, was before the cosmos. Well, something had to make that infinite cosmic ocean into the solar system, you know, with all these planets and stars. Either of those versions of the story requires someone or something, not really someone, it has to be something to cause that matter to be something, unless you believe that it was always that way, which is an option.
What do you mean, that, always that way?
Right, you could just say, Aristotle actually believed this, that the entire cosmos was always pretty much the way it is now. And that it has never been different.
So that water bottle has, like, always been here?
No, people made that. But he's talking about the sun, the moon, the stars. Yeah. Living creatures, the life cycles of nature. You know, he knew...
No evolution?
Yeah, he didn't believe in evolution at all. Yeah. So, but anything that changed, some things did change, according to him. But... you know, he didn't really think important things changed, just like little details, you know, that are no big deal. So this is one thing that he thinks that the early thinkers came short on, is the efficient cause. So efficient, it's kind of a weird word. You can call it the agent cause. Something or something makes it happen. So matter by itself is just inert stuff. And you got to do something with it. So, but he does find that among early thinkers and poets who are important to him, there is a hint of this. So, many of the early thinkers, especially Empedocles and Heraclitus, thought that fire was the source of movement.
Mm-hmm.
So they would choose one of their elements that seemed to move on its own, like Anaximenes said air, Heraclitus said fire, they would choose something that moved on its own as like a special, more fundamental thing. So it's good to have, so even if you have one of your elements and it moves itself, then that's combining the material cause, as Aristotle calls it, with the efficient cause. So that's fine. You can do that. You know, it's okay. But there's still two different kinds of causes. So he wants to discuss these two ideas separately, because some people separate them, other people combine them. So that's all. He's just being systematic. So the earliest person that they know of is who had an idea of the efficient cause was Hesiod. Now, you know who Hesiod is?
Never heard that name.
Okay, so he kind of like wrote the Greek Bible. So in one sense, Homer wrote the Greek Bible, but that was the story of wars and gods interfering with kingdoms and stuff. But Hesiod wrote a poem called... I forget what it was called, but it's about the origin of the universe and about the creation.
Mm-hmm.
So at first there was the cosmic ocean, and then he said there was broad-breasted earth, Gaia, right? So those are two material elements. But then he said there was Eros, chief among immortals. So Eros means love. So this is a common thing that people think, that love was somehow, or desire, because like love in the exalted sense is phileo in Greek, like Philadelphia. And that's a sort of, and then there's another word, agape, which is more exalted sorts of love. But eros is sort of the kind of love that like animals have, right? Humans have it too, but animals have it. Probably even plants, according to the Greeks. And probably the cosmos itself has Eros, because Eros was one of the first of the gods, according to Hesiod. Which, in one sense, Eros was the son of Aphrodite, right? Or was it the daughter? I don't know. Of Aphrodite.
Never heard that one.
But Hesiod says it's like one of the earliest. And Empedocles makes Eros like one of the two primary efficient causes. So we'll get to that later. Actually, we'll get to it now. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, love and hate.
Yeah. So Empedocles said that love was the... There were two efficient causes. So he believed in four elements that just kind of sat there. And then there's two causes. Eros, which takes the elements, separate elements like earth and water and air and fire, and combines them into one thing. So that's really important. That's love. And then eris, which is strife, separates the elements from union. So like all the under eris, all the water would go into the ocean. But under love, some of the water would come together with fire and air and water and earth and to become a living creature. So love is responsible for like living creatures, really. So, and then another guy named Anaxagoras said that mind caused matter to form. That somehow there was a mind in addition to the matter out there.
Mm-hmm.
There was a mind somewhere. And the mind made stuff. Okay, so Aristotle says that Anaxagoras was obviously, in one sense, he was like a whole step above, because he finally introduced the idea that, you know, there's not just matter, but there's like things make sense and things are ordered for purposes. And if you look at the world, you can see, yeah, it's ordered for a purpose. You know, there's like trees. You know, this is all four elements are in a tree. And they're all shaped just perfectly to make more trees, right? So that this tree can stand up, get the energy to put down pine cones and create more trees. And it's like a really awesome thing. So that's the idea that something makes those elements do it. And that's the efficient cause. So anyway. Let's see, I think that, let me take a look here. But like the thing that Aristotle doesn't like about this is that like Anaxagoras, who has this sort of god mind running the universe, he tends to just...
Who's it?
The what?
Who's that?
Anaxagoras, he had mind. So there was matter and then there was mind. So mind is kind of like God.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing about Anaxagoras is he's like a creationist. He seems to believe that at one time there was nothing, and then this mind took all the matter and made everything. So Aristotle criticizes him. Well, he says he's great in the sense that obviously, there needs to be a discussion of the agent cause or efficient cause that makes things happen. But in another sense, he only brings this cause into play when he can't explain anything. He's not systematic. So there's a concept in the modern world called God of the Gaps. Have you ever heard that?
No.
Okay, well, you'll like this. God of the Gaps is the criticism that people only explain things using God when they can't explain things.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you don't have an explanation for something, then you say, well, God did it. And that to Aristotle, it's what he seems to think Anaxagoras does.
Mm.
He says, you know, Anaxagoras just brings in mind when he can't come up with a reason why matter would act this way. So that's a criticism that's, I think, pretty valid. And Empedocles is a lot more systematic, I think, in looking at the agent causes as forces of nature that aren't arbitrary and things like that. They're more like forces of nature like what we think of today. And so you have the four elements, and they all behave in the way that they want to by their very nature. So elements will, like, they behave based on what force is dominant in the world. So you remember when we talked about the cosmic cycle? Do you remember Empedocles' cosmic cycles?
Yeah. So everything started because of... Everything was like one or something? Or everything was all like a bunch of random stuff?
At
monsters?
Once, So it's the opposite of
forget which one it started at.
Yeah, it's the opposite of Anaxagoras' creationism, where there was one beginning. For Empedocles, there's been an infinite number of beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could choose any part of the cycle to be the beginning, but he just seems to choose the sphere. And the sphere is when everything is combined into one thing. And that's the maximum love. So that's kind of like before the Big Bang, in a sense. But before the Big Bang, there's like nothing there, really.
I mean, we don't know what was there.
Yeah, we don't know what was there.
We're just assuming there was nothing, because we don't know what's outside of our universe.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's highly unlikely that there was, like, you know, Ontario or, you know, Africa in there, or some continent, and, you know, with suburbs and jungles or something. You know, I just think it was like a bunch of particles squished together in very high energy or something like that. You know, it wasn't like a cosmos, right? And so it seems it's hard to know what the sphere was for Empedocles. But if you think that love, as I said earlier, is what causes the elements to come together and form living creatures, and then why wouldn't the sphere be a big living creature? Just like the most awesome living creature ever. Or maybe it's a whole living cosmos, right? Some vast thing that we can't even imagine what it is, but it's all interrelated and alive, as opposed to our current cosmos.
It'd be like a giant thing that we haven't discovered yet.
Yeah.
Like, you know, giant, a lot of energy and a bunch of weird stuff.
Yeah. I kind of think it might have been like Ego the Living Planet. Remember
that? That went through my head, and then I decided he was evil.
Yeah, but
so it couldn't be the...
No, Eros, or I mean...
Love.
Eros is good.
Yeah.
Eros is bad, according to Empedocles. But they... there's some problems with Empedocles' system, but one is that when you combine everything into one thing, then you destroy things, right?
Yeah.
And that seems to be the way that Empedocles talks about the sphere. But when he talks about the elements combining into, like, organs. So he thought that there were separate elements. Under strife, the elements were all separate. They hate each other, so they separate. And when you look at the cosmos, when you look at our world, that's generally what happens. Most of the Earth is under your feet. And it's all in one mass. There's not much Earth that's like, I guess, what kind of Earth is not under your feet? I mean, if you take a rock and you throw it up, but then it comes right back down.
Every other planet that's... has
no,
rocks on it.
He doesn't
unless
believe
he means
that.
Specifically Earth.
Yeah, he doesn't believe the planets are Earth.
Right.
He believes they're all fire. So the fire is up there. So the fire is the highest, and strife in the universe makes the fire want to go up. So as soon as you have a fire, they believe fire always wants to go up. If you hold your hand over a fire, it's hot, right? So it must be trying to go up. So they think that fire wants to go way up there, and then there's air, and then air wants to go above water, obviously, and water goes above earth.
Wait, if fire was like the first thing, then, but what about fire need, like fire needs something to burn on.
Well, they think
needs
that,
air, it needs
oh,
earth,
yes.
It needs water.
That's a weak point in Empedocles' thing. Why does fire burn stronger when you blow air on it, right? And like so like most people thought that fire was trapped inside other matter, and that you're just kind of releasing it from being trapped, and then it's going into the sky and you're using it as it's escaping. That's the way they thought about fire. That's the way they thought about it. And I thought about this all the time when I was studying Empedocles. So I was like, you know, just anybody who builds a fire and works with it knows that this is not going to work. But the thing is, to be fair, every scientific theory has things that doesn't work.
That's a pretty big thing that doesn't work.
But it's a problem. There's lots of things that doesn't work. And if you read the first edition of, even the final edition of Darwin's Origin of Species, he mentions two really big things that are major objections to his theory. And he has no answer to them, but he says that the things that it does work for are so superior to every competing theory that he thinks that people will basically find an answer to these questions. And they did. They found an answer to these questions. So I won't go into what they were, but every scientific theory has problems. And most scientists know the problems with their theory, and they're working on them. So, anyway. But for Empedocles, these problems were never resolved. And not until, the modern era did we get past four-element theory. But he at least had elements in the same sense that we think of them today. And he had forces of nature. And the forces of nature caused the elements to move in a certain way. So that's good. And what's more, the forces of nature, one of the two forces of nature, had defined into its nature combining to make living creatures. And that's one thing that's really weak with atomism. It's a very intelligent theory of matter in terms of non-living systems.
Wait, but atomism is a good way to incorporate fire into us, because what else are you going to put fire? Because if all the four elements are combining to make a human or a other animal, then, where's the fire? So, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's really good in terms of, just basic, the dynamics of physical changes, and building fires and stuff like that and making houses and whatever. But what I meant was, it's kind of weak in terms of living creatures. How do living creatures exist? It doesn't seem to, why do all these atoms just come together into the form of living creatures? And it seems like the last thing you would think that an atom would do if you understood the shapes of atoms and things like that. And now we still believe in atoms, and we know that they came together to form living creatures, but we have a theory of how atoms would do that, whereas they didn't have the slightest theory back then, right?
Wait, how?
What?
How did the first living creature happen?
It had to be an arrangement of molecules such that this arrangement of molecules would catalyze its own synthesis, other instances of that molecule or collection of molecules. It's kind of a difficult thing to just throw in as a casual, comment.
I need to know that answer.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? When we're talking about that makes sense. So when you're talking about the very first collection of molecules that could make a copy of itself, that's what the first living creature was. It was a collection of molecules that could make a copy of itself such that then that copy could then make another copy of itself. So if you think of all the molecules, let's say H2O. H2O is a molecule. Now, actually, water can catalyze making copies of itself. If you have free oxygen and hydrogen nearby, it'll catalyze the formation of new water molecules. But there's no there's certain things that make it not alive, such as there's no diversity. All of them are exactly the same, therefore they don't evolve. So that's another thing that has to happen. It has to be collections of molecules or individual molecules that could be slightly different from each other and yet still accomplish the same replication function, but replicate in slightly different ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you need. And so we've already talked about, think about how many of the causes that we've spoken about are in there. You have the matter, and then you have the efficient cause. The molecule has to cause a new instance of itself to be formed. That's the agent cause. And that's what natural change is. A thing causes a copy of itself to be made. That means it's a natural agent cause. And so, you know, they actually, nobody really spelled out this idea that I just told you about the definition of life until Aristotle. And it's in a book called On the Soul. And he talks about the stuff, but that's not in the, and in some places the metaphysics he talks about it, but he doesn't focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but it is an important thing, and I think it's one of the most important concepts. So that's the material cause, and then there's the agent cause. But there's still two more causes left. You remember what they are?
Okay, well, there's the agent, the reason, the matter. Are those all correct?
And the form.
Oh.
Yeah, the reason.
We said agent, and you said no, so I assumed that meant that wasn't one of them.
Oh, yeah. No. It's like that wasn't the one we were talking about at that moment.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, so he said earlier that there's the form. So when we gave an explanation of the first living creature, all four of those causes are in that. And there's nothing left out. So the definition of a living creature is there has to be some kind of matter. And it takes that matter is arranged in a certain form such that that form causes a change in the surrounding matter so that you make a new instance of that same thing, right? So it shapes the surrounding matter into the same form that it has.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the purpose of it, is to continue that life cycle. So you have all four of those causes in it. And I don't think there's anything left out of the definition of what a living creature is other than those four things. And I think that that's what Aristotle is, why he thinks there's only four causes. Now, there is a fifth thing that incorporates all of these, and that's called substance. But he's going to work his way up to that later. And before he gets to that, we're going to go into two other schools of thought which really focus on, they didn't like matter, and they didn't like stuff that moves matter. They thought that was kind of uninteresting. What they liked was they liked forms, and they liked goodness and purpose, right? So they were the opposite of these materialists. And so, Aristotle, in our next episode, we're going to focus on these other two schools of thought, and they are the Pythagoreans and the Platonists. And they're really weird. And it's going to be, so we can't just tack them on the end of this thing. Well, I do want to hint that out. They're the weirdest things you could possibly, philosophies, like, it's just like, get ready for really weirdness. Like, what we've talked about this far is kind of like modern science, and it's very familiar compared to what's coming up. So, anyway, and it's very enjoyable, too. But I think it'll be clear how similar Pythagoras and Plato are just certain types of modern thought, especially mathematical physics and math-heavy sciences generally depend a lot on Pythagoras and Plato.